From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour will be made in 19 days, Election Day. In less than 3 weeks, New York voters will decide whether to keep Andrew Cuomo as governor or elect someone else. Green Party candidate Howie Hawkins says he is the real progressive in this race, attacking Cuomo as a conservative on economic issues, obsessed with cutting taxes instead of helping people find work. Hawkins ran for governor in 2010, received more than 59,000 votes, giving the Green Party an automatic ballot line, and he's in line based on polls to get a lot more than that this time around. He ran for the Senate in 2006. He's here in studio as the campaign makes that final turn toward November 4th. Howie Hawkins, welcome back to Connections.
It's good to be here.
Well, thank you for being here. This has been sort of a strange gubernatorial race. You have your positions on most issues. If you actually look at parties, seem to line up clearly with the Working Families Party. Of course, they're not supporting you in this campaign. They had wavered during the primary on whether to support Governor Cuomo. A little history, if our listeners had forgotten, that they ultimately endorsed the governor only after he promised to campaign actively for a Democratic state Senate. This morning, my colleague Karen DeWitt reported that the governor has not fulfilled that promise at all. The governor told the Washington Post that if you go left of the Working Families Party, you, quote, fall off the face of the earth. A state co-chair of the WFP told me they did not appreciate that comment. And now, as Karen DeWitt reports, Cuomo and Hochul are pushing the new Women's Equality Party, which could take votes away from the Working Families Party. So, Howie, this morning, I emailed a state co-chair of the Working Families Party in Buffalo. I wanted to know, are they considering shifting to support you? Have they been let down? This is the entire response I received an hour ago from the Working Families Party. Quote, we are still on board with the governor. What do you make of that?
Well, they are compromised by the money they get from Democratic politicians. The majority of their money does not come from unions, doesn't come from members, comes from Democratic politicians like a Clinton, a Schumer, a Spitzer, a Cuomo, who gets their money from the real estate industry, from Wall Street, from the big corporations. So in the end, they're really just an operation arm of the Democratic Party. They are paid to do the field organizing, the phone calls and the door knocking. And if they don't get that money from the Democrats, they're out of business. So forget their program. They got to get paid, and that's why they're with the governor. As conservative as he's been, as contradictory to the Working Families platform as he has been, whether it's fully funding public schools, cutting taxes for working people by raising taxes on the very rich, right on down the line. So they're in a bind. You know, I think a lot of the rank and file people are voting for me. Their officers got to toe the line, but I hear from their members, even state committee members, were voting for Howie. They were saying after they, you know, did that deal with Cuomo, they were still saying Teachout in the primary and Hawkins in the general, and that's what we're hearing.
But even Zephyr Teachout has so far declined to endorse you.
She's going to make a decision on October 28th. I've talked to her. I don't think she's going to endorse Governor Cuomo. That would just be totally contradictory to what she did. I would like her endorsement. I'd welcome it. But the important thing is that the people that voted for her seem to be coming to me. That's what we're hearing.
I guess that what I'm saying is Zephyr Teachout and you don't seem to have a whole lot of difference. You and Zephyr Teachout and the Working Families Party don't seem to have a whole lot of difference. But we're not seeing a lot of things square up in terms of support. And to you, does that indicate that there is more at play than actual issues?
Yes. It's the way Working Families gets paid. And they're compromised. The Green Party, as a principle, will not take corporate money. We will not coalesce or cross-endorse the two major parties funded by the 1%. We're going to be politically independent of the corporate power structure and the parties that represent them, the Democrats and Republicans. We have two parties owned by the 1%. We need a People's Party. We need one of our own.
I know you've wanted a chance to debate. That's coming next Wednesday, the 22nd, Buffalo News hosting. Only debate scheduled, at least for you, Howie, and what are your thoughts about 6 days from now? What's going to happen?
Well, I'm happy for that opportunity, but the voters deserve a series of debates because in an hour with four candidates, you really can't get into, you know, much about the policies. We have 1 minute to respond to the questions, which is very brief. We need a series, and I just was reading before I came in here that yesterday Governor Cuomo was doing his launch of his book at Barnes & Noble's, and he said questions about the campaign are out of line, and the reporters refused to, you know, play along with that. That is so disrespectful to the voters. You know, he's out promoting a book instead of talking about what he's going to do in his second term. And the voters deserve to hear that. And I hope they'll put that in their minds as they make a judgment as to who to vote for in this election.
And just to elaborate on Howie's point there, my colleagues over at 13 Wham News had an interview scheduled with Governor Cuomo, and they were told that they could only ask about his book. And my colleagues at 13 Wham News said they would not limit the scope of the questions, and the governor then canceled the interview. The governor has been invited on this program since January, has not taken us up on that. So we're hoping that that will change. So, you know, I guess I'm just saying that right now there is a consistency in that he feels that his message is plenty clear without his appearing for interviews. Would I like for him to sit with an interview? Sure. And you'd like to see more debate.
Absolutely. You were talking earlier about the Women's Equality Party. I think he has been very bad on women's issues. First of all, those 10 items in the Women Equality Agenda were separate items before he put them together to brand himself as a social progressive. He's so economically conservative that he can't claim the mantle of being socially progressive. 9 of those 10 things could have passed. The Senate was willing to pass them, but he held those 9 things, which deal with things like pay equity and domestic violence, hostage to the 10th, which was about abortion rights. We could have got the 9 passed 2 years ago, benefiting women now, and then focus this election on the reproductive rights. And it wasn't just Republicans, there were a couple Democrats that should have been challenged on that in the state Senate. And we could have had a focused debate. Now it's all, you know, all in one big ball, and it's kind of confusing as to what the issue is there. Plus, those 10 points don't deal with the issues that really concern working class women. Child care, it's really hard to get child care and afford it. The minimum wage, it's a poverty wage, and the majority of minimum wage workers are women. If you're a single mother and need public assistance, the amount of cash assistance you get is half the poverty line. And this governor stopped a rise in the grant of just $1 a day for a family of 3 in his first budget. I mean, he does not show concern for working class women, and that's probably the biggest concern of women. They're having, you know, we call it the feminization of poverty. And even if you got a, you know, somewhat decent job, it's hard to make ends meet. And that should be part of a women's equality agenda. And it's not being talked about by this Women's Equality Party.
We're talking to Howie Hawkins in studio, running for governor on the Green Party line. And the last time, Howie, you were on this program, you spoke about your plan to guarantee a job for everyone, full employment. And our listeners had some questions about that. I do as well. And so let's start with this. Can you explain the full employment plan?
You should have the right to a job if you're an adult willing and able to work. And if you can't find it in a private sector, you should be able to go to the employment office, not the unemployment office, and food stamps and Medicaid, and get your job. And the community should plan those jobs and community services and fixing up infrastructure like we did with the Works Progress Administration back during the Roosevelt era, or the public employment program that Nixon put in with a minor recession in 69 that became known as the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, CETA. We've done this before. We know how to do it. That should be the backup. But I believe we can create full employment by committing to 100% clean energy by 2030. In the next 15 years, building out that system, which is technically and economically feasible with commercially available technology today, according to a study by Stanford and Cornell scientists, economists, and engineers. And their study found that building that system out would create 4.5 million jobs, good middle-income jobs in construction and manufacturing. That is 6 times the official unemployment rate. People be moving back to New York State to build this system out, and that system would set an example for the nation and the world of how to take effective climate action, stimulate the economy. The renewable energies with a smart grid and the distributed energy from the wind and the sun, the electric rates in the next decade would be half than what they will be if we stick with nuclear and fossil fuels. I mean, it should be a no-brainer to go this path, but we've got Astorino out there saying we need to do fracking and stick with this old dirty 19th century fossil fuel technology. And even Astorino has banned fracking waste from going into his own county, Westchester. He signed a law. But Andrew Cuomo's DEC has allowed it to come into southern tier municipal landfills and also the frack fluid to be poured on roads for de-icing and dust suppression. So in some ways, Astorino's been more anti-fracking than Andrew Cuomo. You look at Andrew Cuomo's draft energy plan, and you will see it's all about gas, pipelines, switching from coal to gas-fired fossil fuel plants, exporting liquefied nitrogen gas off Long Island, storing the gas in salt caverns by Seneca Lake. The whole infrastructure is being built, and all he has to do is grant permission, which he had a trial balloon a couple of years ago where you protect the New York and Syracuse watersheds and then let local communities go ahead with it if they wanted. And I think that's what we'll see after the election if he's elected. I'm the only candidate saying ban fracking and go 100% clean energy.
Okay, and when it comes to this jobs program, you're talking about fixing infrastructure and moving toward clean energy. So if someone can't find a job in the private sector, they go into the government jobs office, they say, in your words, I want my job. And it's going to take some retraining. Have you figured out what this government would need to spend on training for a full employment program?
Well, first let me say, we would create a lot of jobs in the private sector by committing to 100% clean energy. But not everybody's cut out for construction work or working in a factory manufacturing things. And we have a lot of community services. So we should have a public jobs program for those people as backup. And it's the same thing we did during the Works Progress Administration. Training was involved for some people that didn't have skills they were for the jobs that were available. It was in part of Nixon's, you know, public employment program that became Comprehensive Employment and Training Act. So that has to be part of it. Now, in terms of costs, the public jobs program, if we did it federally, it would 80% pay for itself because we'd be saving on public assistance, food stamps, Medicaid, housing subsidies, heat subsidies, and people would be paying taxes because they'd be, you know, making a living wage. If you do it at the state level, because those are federal programs, you don't save as much. And I did the calculations. Forget the clean energy. If we had to create 750,000 jobs publicly, we couldn't afford it in New York State. So what I would do with the public jobs program is target it to those high unemployment communities. We're the most segregated state in the nation by both race and class, by both housing and schooling. And when you have these hyper-segregated communities, you don't have access to public transportation that's convenient to get you to jobs, say, in the suburbs. You don't have the social networks to get you into the job market. This is where the public jobs program would have the most beneficial effect, and that's where I would target it.
Are you saying, though, that the state, if there wasn't a federal program, just New York State could not afford a Jobs for Everyone program right now?
Not 750,000 jobs. No, that would be beyond our means because the savings are really in the federal benefits. So we'd be saving the federal government money, but not ourselves so much.
Well, and look, I know this is sort of a thought experiment, and but there's not going to be a federal jobs program. So on the state level, what you're saying is it's a program that you like, but it's not feasible financially.
To be full employment only with public jobs. But if we do the clean energy, we'll have a residual for those people that can't work construction and manufacturing or have the administrative skills, because there'll be administrative jobs in building the system out. We should have some residual public employment jobs, particularly for the people that are having a hard time getting into the labor market. People on public assistance, we got to get away from workfare where you do some dumb, no future job to get your welfare benefit and give people a real job.
Okay, we're talking to Howie Hawkins, Green Party candidate for governor, about his jobs plan. You have said, by the way, that if you come into a government office, you get a job. As long as you're kind of showing up, you're going to keep the job. But does that preclude the government then from being able to fire people who are not effective?
No, absolutely not. You got to do the job to get paid. And if you don't, you get fired and go to the back of the line and come back in and give it another try. Now, you know, some young people or some people without experience in the labor market, they may not be good workers, but, you know, they'll find out what they got to do to be good workers if they're going to, you know, maintain a job. So absolutely, they got to produce so that we're getting our money's worth for what we're paying them.
And economists are, I think, maybe a little bit concerned that in a Howie Hawkins system, we would see more private sector jobs become, by necessity, government jobs, because most economists say that if you raise the minimum wage, there's not a whole lot of impact one way or another on employment. What raising the minimum wage does is it allows workers who are making less to make more. It allows families to make more and to keep more, unless you more than double it. And in this case, even an economist who supports a minimum wage increase that Elizabeth Warren has touted, Arindrajit Dubé, has said, we don't know what happens with a $15 minimum wage, but there probably would be disruption. Are you concerned that the private sector would recoil at $15 an hour and we'd see people lose their jobs in the private sector?
Well, some businesses may not be able to afford that, but as Franklin Roosevelt said when he started his administration in the height of the Great Depression, 1933, He said if a business can't afford to pay a living wage, maybe they shouldn't be in business. But we have big corporations like Walmart and McDonald's and Burger King that do not pay a living wage. In fact, you get a job there and they give you the food stamps application. And the rest of us who have decent paying jobs are subsidizing that big corporation who are paying sub-poverty wages. So there would be an adjustment in the labor market. We'd create a floor, and it would benefit businesses because it would create greater demand for goods and services for people that were really low wage. Now they have more to spend, and business can then invest and hire to meet that demand.
Let me read more of what Aaron Dubé said again. He's an economist that Elizabeth Warren has cited in her efforts to raise the minimum wage, but not necessarily to $15. And Dubé says, quote, "We don't know what happens to employment of low-skilled workers when the minimum wage is doubled. If it falls, that dilutes any stimulative impact. If employers pass along the increased wage in the form of higher prices, that means inflation." Concern about that?
Yes, but that means we need to reinforce antitrust laws so that markets are competitive. And if the market's failing and you have inherent monopolies, it should be publicly owned, operated as a public utility at cost for public benefit, not for private profit. There are ways to deal with that, and it would be different in different industries, no doubt. And a lot of those companies can absorb the cost. The Walmart and McDonald's can, and there have been studies that show that. It would have to come out of high CEO and executive salaries. I mean, just this has really got out of hand in this country. Coming out of World War II, the CEO of a big Fortune 500 company would make 8 times what the average worker in that company would make. Today, they make 300 times and up. And, I work for a company, UPS, where the CEO makes something like $15 million a year. That's thousands of times more than I make per hour and per year. And he may be good, but he's not thousands of times better than me. He's sitting up in an air-conditioned office, and I'm sweating with those boxes. And his company wouldn't operate without people like me.
Well, David on Twitter says, does Mr. Hawkins think there should be a limit to what people can make, and what should the top tax rate be?
Well, at the state level, I want to go back to the 1970s. So in the top bracket, which would be $4 million and up, when you hit that $401 million, $400 million and $1, you'd be paying about 15%. But the bottom bracket, that's your first $8,000 as an individual or $16,000 as a couple, would be cut from its 2% now back to, I'm sorry, it's 4% now back to the 2% it was in the 1970s. So the lower and middle income earners would be paying less taxes. And it would really be the top 5% and particularly the top 1% who have really benefited since the tax structure was flattened. In 1980, the top 1% got 10% of all income in the state. Since 2007, they've gotten between 30 and 35% each year. That their income has tripled and their tax rates have been cut in half. And that's why we have fiscal issues. And then we give tax cuts to the rich and pay for it with cuts to our schools. We need new priorities and we need a more progressive tax structure.
Jake writes to us, why are all the arguments about minimum wage worried about a sudden hit? Just raise it gradually until it matches inflation-adjusted numbers compared to when it was first instituted. When it was first instituted, the 1930s, I'm trying to, and forgive me, Howie, I don't know if, I think it'd be, what, around $11 an hour today, something like that, $10 to $12 an hour now?
I know if we had the wage in 1968 today, it would be about 1070.
Okay, so around $11 an hour.
But the comparison I like to make is when the Civil Rights Movement marched in 1963 on Washington for jobs and freedom, one of their demands was a $2 minimum wage. And they did that based on what it would take to pay for basic expenses at that time. You adjust that $2 an hour in 1963 to today's inflation-adjusted prices, and that would be $15.55 an hour. And I think that's a reasonable standard as a floor for the labor market.
To Jake's question, would you do it overnight or would you do it incrementally in steps?
Well, we're only at $8 now. It has to be done incrementally. I mean, I've run small businesses, and I'm actually helping start one right now, a food co-op in a USDA-certified food desert, and we've worked on the wage scales and the health plans and everything. And you need to give businesses time to adjust their budgets. So I would phase it in. I wouldn't drag it out a long time. I'd maybe 3 years, and, you know, phase it up. So that would give businesses plenty of time to adjust their budgets.
Okay, eventually ending at $15 or north of $15 an hour. Back in January on this program, Brian Kolb, the Assembly Minority Leader, argued what a lot of Republicans argue, which is that the minimum wage is not supposed to be a living wage, that it's supposed to be an entry-level wage that young people have before they get higher-paying jobs. And I think what we have here is probably just a philosophical divide, right? I mean, I think you're saying, no, that's wrong, that people ought to be able to take care of themselves or a reasonable family on that. Is it a philosophical divide?
No, he's wrong on the facts. There are lots of people, a high percentage, and I don't recall the exact percentage, of adults raising families who are working on a minimum wage. I was talking with a woman yesterday.
He's saying they shouldn't be able to, he's saying that's a bad idea for an adult trying to raise a family. Those jobs, yeah.
I was with a woman yesterday who's supporting my campaign. She's been a college professor. She has a PhD. And all she can get right now is $10 a week at Taco Bell. She's not doing that as entry level. She's doing that because it's the only thing she can get right now. And that's a problem for a lot of us in the working class. We don't have good opportunities. You look at the projections by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as what jobs are being created. 9 out of the 10 fastest growing jobs are near minimum wage jobs. And so we've got to raise the floor, because otherwise you're not going to get your packages or your food served. Or the people doing it are going to be living in poverty, and then we got a whole lot of other problems.
All right, we're going to get to the phones with Howie Hawkins, Green Party candidate for governor, and let's get Don in Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon. Mr. Hawkins, I wish you all the luck in the world. The thing that you said at the first part of your interview here was that the two major parties, Republicans and Democrats, are tools of the 1%. The Democrats may be more subtle about it. They may hide their intentions more than the Republicans, but they both are the tools of the Wall Street billionaires. The one thing that attracted me and to you and turned me off completely about Governor Cuomo is that this past summer, when Gaza was being hammered by the Israeli forces, he decided he was going to take a trip to Israel. When he went to Israel, he was asked by the Palestinian leaders to come and visit things that are important to them, come and see what's going on in Gaza. He said the schedule didn't allow for it. That turned me right off. The man is not running just for governor of New York State. He's running for president in 2016. Again, I wish you all the luck in the world. Everything you said, I agree with, and I hope you do very well.
Thank you, Don. Go ahead, Howie.
Well, yeah, I was disturbed by what Governor Cuomo did on that trip. New York, because of our large Jewish population and our status as the financial capital of the world, you know, we have a lot of pension money invested in companies that do business in Israel. We do have to address that question, but the U.S. should be a neutral broker if it's going to be constructive in the Middle East, and to give unconditional support to Gaza right after all those civilians were, I'm sorry, unconditional support to Israel right after all the civilians in Gaza were killed, was not setting ourselves up to be a neutral broker and help the two parties come together to adjust settlement. And I think he was pandering. It was more about New York politics than helping the people in the Middle East or helping world peace.
And he's getting ready for a trip now to Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic. He's been traveling a lot, but again, the governor's office says New York is a state that has relationships around the world, and he's trying to preserve and strengthen those.
Yeah, well, sometimes people say, why I'm running for governor, I can't win. And so I think the same question could be asked of Rob Astorino, the Republican, because he's pretty far down in the polls. In fact, I'm closer to him than he is to Cuomo. But the same thing could be asked of Andrew Cuomo. Why is he running for president? Because he can't win.
Don in Brighton. Go ahead, Don.
Hi. You know, one of the comments, they're talking about raising taxes on the rich. And I have to agree at a federal level, but if we raise them too high, they move out. Here in our county, we had one of our very high taxpayers move out of the county because the tax rate was too high. So you got to have a balance. You can't be way higher than the other states. I mean, as a nation, we need to raise the taxes on the ultra rich, but if we get them too high, we'll have them all move out of the state and you lose the taxes you're getting.
Don, thanks for the call. Howie, go ahead.
I think you're basically right in principle, and it's better to have a progressive federal system with revenue sharing from the federal government to the states. But actually, New York's top bracket is lower than New Jersey's. We're at 8.82 with the surcharge. It's going down to 6.85 in a year or two. New Jersey's like 8.9, a little bit higher. But then next door in Pennsylvania, it's 3 point something. And, you know, there was a study done by academics and published in an economic journal a couple years ago, and it wondered if people weren't moving from New Jersey over to Philadelphia and Pennsylvania to pay lower taxes, and they found they weren't. If you're getting wealthy making money here in New York, you're going to lose your opportunity to make that money if you move somewhere else. And if you're somebody like Tom Golisano, who made a big deal about moving down to Florida, he still has to pay income taxes on money he makes in New York. So, you know, you can run, but you can't completely hide from your tax obligations if you're making money in New York. So I don't think that's such a big concern. If you get real high, yes, people would leave, but 15% for dollars you make over $4 million is not going to make you run, because what that means is for every dollar you make, you're keeping 85 cents of it. Why would you run away from that 85 cents? You know, in your next $1 million, it would be $850,000. Why would you walk away from that? No, you're making good money. Help fund the public sector. The public avenues, the public sector is the public avenues of private commerce. You need good infrastructure, education. That's helping you with your business. So I don't think the rich are going to run away. And if they do, they're fools. And if they go, good riddance. Somebody else will get rich doing what you were doing before you left.
John, thanks for calling. John, you're on with Howie Hawkins.
First of all, great show. Great show. I listen to you a lot, but when you have a mainstream Democrat or Republican on this time of year, I turn the show off. This is very interesting. So thank you. Number one.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Number two, the whole thing about tax policy is very interesting, because the taxes, the percentage of taxes that corporations pay in America has been going down steadily. And now with unlimited campaign contributions, you know, 20 years from now, if it keeps going like this, they're going to be paying nothing. So the whole thing about taxing corporations and the rich and driving them out, this is our government. We got to take back our government. I'm a registered Democrat, vote mostly Democrat, but not this year. I'm voting Green Party. And I think this, and again, thanks for the show. It's very interesting. I'm not going to take any more time. I just love the conversation.
Well, I appreciate it, John. Thanks for the call. And certainly we've made a point on this program that we don't only invite candidates who poll high. But Howie Hawkins' poll numbers are, you got 59,000 votes last time around, which was what percentage?
1.3%.
Yeah, and the polls now have you at significantly higher than 1.3%. So you could end up with several hundred thousand votes.
Well, the last poll last week was Quinnipiac. It had me at 9%. That's the second poll that had me at 9%. That's over 400,000 votes, assuming a $4.5 million person vote like we had in the last two election cycles. So, and we're going up.
Well, and I don't know that you can or can't win, but do you sense that your campaign, assuming you don't win, is about, do you actually believe that you are changing progressive conversation and perhaps the Democratic Party?
I think if we maintain the vote the polls say we'll get now, that would be more than any independent progressive third-party candidate for statewide office has got in New York history. That's going back to the Liberty Party, the abolitionists, right through the populists, the socialists, the Labor Party. Henry Wallace was the one that got the record for 8.3% in 1948, the Progressive Party candidate for president. So it would be historic. I think it would establish us as the third major party in New York. And I think if you look at what's been going on in our state, like last year in Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and Albany, there was no Republican candidate for mayor. It was Greens versus Democrats. In New York City, the Democratic enrollment to Republican enrollment is a 6-to-1 ratio. So the Democrats in the city are the establishment party, and the Greens are the progressive alternative. And then you go out to the rural areas, the Democrats have written that off. And you have entrenched Republican cliques. I talk to grassroots Republicans, and they don't like the real estate-backed, you know, guys cutting deals. I think the Greens can go there and be the alternative to entrenched Republicans, where they're getting a little too cozy with their business partners.
Looking at some of Howie Hawkins' proposals, a single-payer health care system. We're seeing Vermont go that way. Howie wants to see New York go that way. Tax credits for renters and a moratorium on home foreclosures, publicly owned power and fuel companies. access to high-speed internet universally. And when you look at, and we've already talked about your jobs program, Rochester City newspaper was split on whom to endorse this season, and Mary Anna Towler wrote a piece endorsing you that landed this week. But she referred to it as a protest vote and added that some of Hawkins' ideas are indeed not realistic. Others may be sound, but they're expensive, and Hawkins' tax reform proposals aren't likely to pay the full cost. I mean, that's something who's supporting you, saying that your programs can't be paid for. Is that wrong?
That is wrong. If we went back to the 1970s tax structure, on the income tax, 95% of us would get a cut, and we'd raise $8 billion more. If we kept the stock transfer tax, which we collected from 1906 until 1981, that would be about $15 billion a year. In the 1970s, we didn't have all this corporate welfare, tax cuts and subsidies for corporations, particularly big politically connected corporations. That's $7 billion a year. You add those numbers together, that's $30 billion in increased state revenue, while 95% of us are paying less in taxes. That's 20% increase in the state budget. And I would devote that to the programs of the Green New Deal and to restoring the revenue sharing we had in the 1970s. That would increase eightfold what we now get from the state, and that would enable our local communities to lower the property taxes. We have the highest in the nation property taxes. It makes business costs high. It makes housing unaffordable, whether you're renting or owning. And it would enable local communities to make their own mind about their priorities. How much do we want to cut our property taxes? How much do we want to put in to bring back our municipal services and our schools? Andrew Cuomo's so-called property tax reform is tiny, it's token, and it's temporary. It ends in 2 years. You got to jump through his hoops. It's one size fits all from the top down. And the average check you're getting right here before the election statewide for your house is $34. You know, I hope the people in this state, I hope their votes can't be bought that cheaply. You know, he's got the brand of property tax relief, but not the substance. What we're talking about would provide real property tax relief, which would, you know, really help particularly, you know, middle class and working class people.
Tim in Pittsburgh, thanks for calling, Tim. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. I have a question to start off with. If we're in this jobs program where everyone gets a job, how many people would that be, probably?
Well, there's 750,000 or so people who are officially unemployed. You could probably double that if you count the people who've given up looking because they're just not getting a job, but they would come back into the labor market if there were jobs available, and the people who are working part-time involuntarily who want a full-time job.
So 1.5 million jobs. That,
so
go ahead, Tim.
Let's say 1.5 million
yes.
jobs that New York State would be employing.
No.
That, no,
no. No, because we would have this clean energy program, which would create over the next 15 years 4.5 million jobs, mainly in construction and manufacturing.
But who are the private companies that are going to employ those
yeah.
people? And why aren't they doing it already if it's going to be a viable program?
Because we haven't set up the policies to incentivize the creation of distributed energy from wind and solar, and we haven't set up a public energy system for the infrastructure. We need to go to a smart grid, so we need to take over the transmission and distribution lines because the investor-owned utilities, we call them the IOUs, they prefer centralized power stations so they can meter what you're getting. If you got rooftop solar and micro wind in your backyard, what you do in a smart grid is sell the excess to the grid and get paid for it when you have excess, and then you buy it when you need it. We'd also set up decentralized energy storage with hydrogen fuel cells. We would set up community power microgrids because not every building has the same exposure to the sun or the same wind situation, so you set up a microgrid and share it around the neighborhood or the town. All these things we need to do through a public energy system, and once you do that, you create enormous opportunities for other businesses to do the installation of solar and wind, the electrical work on setting up the smart grid, the retrofitting of buildings for efficiency and insulation, setting up the heating and cooling with ground source heat pumps so we don't need to burn gas to keep buildings or propane to keep our buildings heated. That would create a lot of small business opportunities as well.
All right, so Tim, it sounds like the assumption is that paves the way for the private sector. Go ahead, Tim.
There's 2 points on that. Central Maine Power went to a smart grid. They created zero jobs. They actually lost jobs because their departments downsize, and the people in those departments who were actually taking care of the electric and gas meters before actually installed the smart grid for Central Main Power, and they were the other people in those departments were reassigned jobs. They hired zero people to put that smart grid in. And solar power, you probably heard what's going on in Wisconsin right now. When you get so many people with solar power, there's only so much storage you can have. And when not everyone can sell back. Everyone thinks that they're going to make all this money because they're selling back to, let's just say, RG&E. It's not how it works. If you get all these people selling back, the price is just going to keep dropping and dropping. In Wisconsin, they're talking about people started off selling back at 14 cents a kilowatt hour. Now they want to drop it to 3 cents a kilowatt hour because they don't know what to do with all this stored energy.
Well, you're talking in both cases about privately owned, investor-owned utilities. And like I said, they don't want you to have, you know, solar panels and wind because they can't meter it. And if you produce it, they don't want to buy it. That's why we need the infrastructure owned publicly, operating at cost for public benefit. As far as outsourcing in Central Maine, they did hire people, but it was private contractors. We have a public system. You look at the municipal utilities, and we have over 50 of them, including the cooperatives in New York State. They did not downsize like National Grid and the other investor-owned utilities, where they think they can, like when we had Sandy, they can all send them down there when there's an emergency, but that overwhelmed them. The investor-owned utilities have been cutting back on utility workers, and then we have problems like when that ice storm hit the North Country, it took them weeks to get it back online. But the publicly owned utilities up there had the staff, and they got back up right away. So that's why you're making my case for a public energy system for the infrastructure of our energy system.
Tim, last word on this one. Go ahead.
Yeah, the word public, and I'm a liberal, and the word public kind of scares me because I just don't know where all this money is coming from. And once the word public gets thrown out there, too, I'm in a union, but you know Danny Donahue is going to want his hands in all this, and you know there's a pension coming for a bunch of people, and things get really, you know, politics get involved, and things get really convoluted, and I think it scares off a lot of people, unfortunately.
Tim, thanks for the call. Howie, go ahead.
Well, we're the public, and it's up to us to hold our publicly owned utilities accountable. And you look in New York, the costs and the efficiency of our municipally owned utility companies are more efficient and provide better service than the investor-owned utilities. So public isn't always less efficient. In some cases, it's more efficient. I think energy is one of those fields. I think another one is healthcare. I mean, just to look at that one, the overhead for private insurance is 30% of your healthcare dollar compared to 3% in Medicare. And that's because the private insurance companies, if they don't have to pay for a service, it goes to their bottom line. So they're always fighting the providers, the hospitals, the doctors, and so forth, for the services. And then every doctor has 2.5 staff people to fight the insurance companies to get paid. It's the most inefficient way you could imagine. If we had a single public payer, a state study showed by 2019, we would be saving $28 billion for New Yorkers than we are going to pay with this mixed system of private insurance and then public for those who can't afford it. So, you know, public isn't the answer to everything, but it is for some things.
John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Howie. Howie, I agree with you on the fact that the corporatists, the large corporation and their allies in government, the big government bureaucracy, is really squeezed the middle class. Huge. But I have to disagree on a major point. Big government is not the answer. Big government has contributed mightily to this recession we've been in since 2008, and the real solution is to slowly move resources out of government into the private sector. We've got enough laws and regulations. If they would have been enforced before 2008, we wouldn't be in this predicament. So big government, big corporations are cahoots. And the solution of this problem is to decrease big government and enforce the laws in place. That's the solution. You're going to take it to a level which is going to be, it's like steroids. It's like the Democrats on steroids.
John, thanks for the call. Howie?
Well, the Democrats had control of the national government after the Great Recession. Wall Street got bailed out, but Main Street got sold out. you know, I'm with you on bringing control down to the local level. We need more home rule in a lot of respects in our government. We need a progressive tax structure and then share the revenues and let us decide our priorities locally. So I'm for decentralization and democratization. The only thing I wouldn't do that with are basic human rights and civil rights. Those should be constitutional and protected from, you know, at any level. I think it's not government versus private sector. It's big unaccountable bureaucracies in the government sector and the private sector versus democratic accountable structures in the private sector and the government sector.
Bonnie, thanks for calling. Bonnie, you're on with Howie Hawkins.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having this interview. A couple of things. One is you were mentioning about Marianne Towers. It's also important to note that the reason she decided that there's a whole list of positive reasons why she decided to support Howie, which is very notable because her past endorsements have been pretty much status quo. So it's very notable that she would go to this direction. The second comment is that when you're talking about public sector jobs, I think one of the things that people maybe don't fully realize is how many public sector services have been cut already. And pretty much the attention has gone to education, which is justifiable in terms of being concerned. But there are many, many other services the public sector provides. And for instance, an example, people with disabilities. There are now 20,000 people in the state of New York waiting for residential services that have been waiting for years and getting nowhere under this governor. So the consequences of not serving those people are, belittling to families, causing a lot more health care needs, because once you don't have the support, your whole stress system is impaired to a greater degree. So I think those things are very, very important. The issues of poverty need a whole lot of follow-up with people who are finding themselves in very difficult struggles. So those things need to be considered because they have a cost, too. My last thing is a question. Howie, I would like to ask you if you could talk about something that I think people get very confused about, and that is your approach to campaign financing versus what is generally the governor's and some of the other folks' minimal approach to that same issue.
Thank you, Bonnie. Go ahead, Howie.
Well, I agree that the public sector has been devastated. I live in Syracuse, and we've closed senior centers, fire stations, lost a quarter of our staff in the schools, in a school district where only about half the kids graduate from high school. And you can't tell me you lay off a quarter of the staff and you're going to improve that dropout rate. I went to the census recently and looked to see how many public sector jobs we've lost in New York since the Great Recession in 2008. It's 400,000, including 40,000 teachers. I mean, there's a jobs program right there, bringing back the fire stations, the senior centers, and the schools. We privatized nursing homes in a lot of counties, and then they go bankrupt because they get milked by the company that came in to do it private, and those seniors are left without a place to go. We've outsourced mental health, and they're not doing the job, and the people who are mentally ill are ended up on the streets. They get picked up by the criminal justice system, which is not able to handle them. So we're creating more problems by not having a revitalized public sector. As far as public campaign financing goes, yes, there was a bill passed through the assembly. It was Sheldon Silver, the speaker's bill. And Cuomo supports a similar bill. He has a program bill there. Jeff Klein has another one for the Independent Democratic Conference. And what they all have in common is that they have a limited amount of public money. You get a 6-to-1 match for contributions of $10 to $175, up to a maximum of public money. But they still leave unlimited private money. So what that looks to me like, a reform that doesn't reform. You put a little public money on top of this old big pile of old private dirty money, and it doesn't change the system. What I've called for, and there's been a bill in the legislature for full public campaign financing. If you opt into public campaign financing by qualifying with a reasonable number of $5 contributions in your petitions, every candidate who opts in gets an equal grant. That levels the playing field for people in the public finance system. And you have to participate in a series of debates. And then if you opt out, at least we know you're running on the private money. Maine does it that way. Arizona does it that way. It works. And I can bring you Republicans from Maine who love the system, because now they don't have to spend all their time dialing for dollars. And that would be the reform I would advocate. And I'm disappointed that a lot of the good government groups that used to be for full public campaign finance have settled for this partial system that really won't change much.
Mark writes in and says, how could you have a moratorium on foreclosures? And let me press that point, because Howie's calling for tax credits for renters. You want more mixed income housing, high quality. And essentially, you've talked about the segregated system that we have in Rochester, across New York, across the country. But when it comes to foreclosures, I think it's one thing to say these policies aggressively target people, maybe unfairly. It's another to say a moratorium on foreclosures for people who probably should be foreclosed upon. I mean, how do you square a moratorium on foreclosures?
Well, we need a moratorium until we get this thing straightened out. Okay. We have had bankers on Wall Street robo-signing, you know, steering people that are qualified for prime mortgages to subprime because they're black and Latino. You know, that's against the law. All kinds of crimes broken, and we haven't put one of those bankers in jail. You want a deterrent for this kind of theft and robbery and fraud? Put some of them in jail. We've got some settlements that, you know, and there's a lot of money actually, but we can't let the rich buy themselves out of jail and then go back to robbing us. So we need a moratorium until we get that straightened out. Now, some people who are irresponsible, yeah, they should be foreclosed. But there are a lot of people who are in a situation where they went in good faith and then the market collapsed, not so much up here in upstate, but down in the Hudson Valley in New York City. And the banks are insisting that they pay that price when it was at the top of the bubble, when the market value is much lower. They're underwater. They can't afford it. And we want to keep people in housing. We want affordable housing. Half the people in the state who rent are paying over 30% of their income. One-third of the homeowners are paying over 30% of their income because of our highest-in-the-nation property taxes. So we need an affordable housing program and a moratorium on foreclosures till we get that in place. Now, I think one thing we need to do, besides lowering the property taxes and putting the crooks in jail who are, you know, setting people up for these foreclosures, is a public housing program, unlike the old ones, which were high-rise, concentrated, putting poor people of color in already segregated communities and increasing segregation. What we need are humanly scaled, scatter site, mixed income in the cities, in the suburbs. They can be green with solar roofs or solar rooftop panels and green roofs and microwind, and the building materials can sequester carbon, so we're drawing carbon out of the atmosphere. So it would be a jobs program, an affordable housing program, an energy program, as well as a program to begin to desegregate and bring us back together. Because none of us, none of our freedom or our material security is secure if we're divided and increasingly polarized into gated communities and impoverished ghettos.
And what pays for that expansion of that program?
Progressive taxation, increased 20% revenues, and we put it into a housing program that begins to build this out. And I think, you know, I think most people, they don't like racial segregation. Most white people in the suburbs would be happy to have Barack Obama and, you know, Eric Holder as neighbors. What they're worried about is the problems of these very poor communities where people are dropping out of school, getting in the streets, and then in the prison system. There's just a lot of problems. They don't want to see that coming. So I think if we begin to implement this progressively, we can get everybody reassured that this is going to work. And we got to bring ourselves back together, because right now we're getting more and more divided and it's not solving a whole lot of problems. Like, take the schools. We got high stakes testing and we're defining the schools as failed in these poor communities. But to really have education reform, we need broader social reform, because in these schools that are having problems, all the problems in the streets and the communities, the families, you know, kids are coming in hungry, angry. They've been fighting in the streets. You got to solve those problems. You can't expect the schools to solve them in isolation from the broader context.
Last caller is Jane. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, well, that's what happens to people when they suffer neglect. They deteriorate. Their habits and thinking deteriorate. But with Cuomo, I see him as a Republican. I see the Green Party is more like the real Democratic Party. And what my problem with Cuomo is that he seems not to take a stand on anything. Fracking, what's he going to do about poverty? What's he going to do about funding inequities in education and not being accessible to people in debates? So I don't get it. And he expects to get reelected, I guess, just because he's an incumbent. We hear a lot of pity parties for the wealthy and their onerous taxes. I get so tired of that. I wish he would talk as much about poverty and what his plan is to eradicate it.
Thank you, Jane. Let's go ahead to Howie because we're running out of time. Go ahead, Howie.
Well, I think a lot of people are seeing that Andrew Cuomo really cannot be trusted. Take fracking. You know, he says he's waiting for the science, but then we get this report last week that the state ordered a study from the federal government on methane leaks from wells drilled for fracking, and they didn't like the results, and they tried to get the conclusions.
That's not how they'd characterize it.
That's how Scott Waldman with Capital New York, independent reporter. He
definitely did. Waldman says the science wasn't changed. The conclusion was softened to say as long as the well casings are well maintained, there shouldn't be a problem.
Well, that's by definition. But we know from the record, like the study that Anthony and Graffia published a few weeks ago about 41,000 wells in southwest Pennsylvania, 5% of them failed right when they were drilled, and 50% will fail within 15 years. He softened the conclusions. He didn't want to accept the science, what the scientists concluded. And he's telling us he's waiting for the science. You know, what do you believe? Or take the Moreland Commission, you know. He says it's independent. Then he says it's mine. He says the Moreland Commission was supposed to investigate the legislature, but the Moreland law is for investigating the executive branch. And when they investigate his donors, he shuts it down. Which is it, Andrew?
Well, Howie Hawkins is the Green Party candidate for governor. I know it's been a busy campaign season for you. We'll see you in the debate next Wednesday. Where else can people go to find out more about Howie Hawkins?
My website, howiehawkins.org, has a lot of information. In fact, they're calling me the policy wonk because I got more information, three times more than Astorino, and Cuomo has none on policy. So take a look, and we'll try to give you as much information as possible. Agree or disagree, at least you know where I stand.
And thank you for letting us know where you stand. That's exactly what this program is about. Howie Hawkins, thanks for your time.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for all your participation to our listeners today. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks to our engineer, Dave Campo. Tomorrow's Healthy Friday right here on Member Supported Public Radio.